This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Now, if Winnipeg gets a save here, they win the hockey game. And the game is essentially on Brad Marchand's stick. Marchand is 0-for-1 this year. He'll race to the puck. Left-handed shot. Picks it up in center. He'll move in. Let a backhander go. Stopped and denied by Hellebuck. Jets win. Jets win. Jets win in a shootout tonight.
The game was on Brad Marchand's stick, but Connor Hellebuck continued his excellent play that we saw through the first 65 minutes of last night's contest. He continued it into the shootout, denying Brad Marchand, denying the Boston Bruins, and leading the Winnipeg Jets to an unexpected 4-3 shootout victory over the Boston Bruins. Good evening, Winnipeg. Good evening, Manitoba. And for all those joining us live this evening at TSN1290.ca and via the iHeartRadio app, we say good evening, universe, and welcome to the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. Drew Mindell, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio on this, the 30th day of January. Gentlemen, good to see you on Bell Let's Talk Day. Obviously a very good cause. We'll be speaking about that later on in the second hour of tonight's program. But the Winnipeg Jets last night looked fairly lackadaisical, looked fairly out of the game, didn't expect to see that third period push led by Kyle Connor and Connor Hellebuck with stellar goaltending resulting in the Jets taking a 4-3 victory.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate, guys, that Kyle Connor isn't going to be credited for the game winner. He obviously scores the shootout winner, but we know that doesn't count. But, you know, a couple of really nice goals, and I thought that that line, the top line of the Jets, of course, really showed up in the third period, because as you mentioned, Drew, the first period was not one of those periods that you're going to write home about, right? And even midway through the game, guys, I think the shots were 24-10 in favor of the Bruins. And sure, the Jets are dealing with the second game of a back-to-back, but it certainly wasn't the effort that they wanted early in the game coming off of that loss against Philadelphia, right, Drew? So I agree with you. It was a little bit unexpected. You didn't really know, and I actually tweeted that. You know, I was interested to see what the Jets' pushback was going to be in that third period because, you know, you're in a situation where if you lose this game, you've lost three in a row now.
It would have been the first time all year that the Jets lost three in a row in regulation.
Right, and I don't think they really look at it like that. I don't think they sit in the dressing room, Shawnee, and they talk about, oh, you know, we can't lose three in a row for the first time. They just didn't want to lose another game because the game against Dallas before the break was not one of their strong games, and the game against Philadelphia, they were a little bit sluggish as well. So, you know, we've seen this Jets team with all the skill they have. They can score goals in bunches and win a game in one period. We've seen that, you know, several times, not just this year, but last year as well. And, you know, Kyle Connor has been, you know, so consistent for the Jets. You know, he's had his slumps, but certainly, you know, yesterday he was the Jets' best player. And, you know, I thought the Lowry-Tanev-Perreault line was good as well. And I thought they were the Jets' best line against Philadelphia. But back to what you said about Connor Hellebuck, he was the Jets' best player. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe his best work was in the shootout. And the shootout is something that, you know, Drew, I don't like. But he made some big saves in the shootout. And, you know, the Jets obviously got the only goal. But, you know, he was very, very solid all game, and he made the big saves when he needed to.
Well, where are the Jets in that game if Connor Hellebuck doesn't basically stand on his head throughout the first period? I mean, I know he ended up giving up two goals at the first period, but on 20 shots, and made a number of highlight reel saves to keep the team in it, and even kept the team in it throughout the second period as well, and until Kyle Connor sort of bang-bang in the third period, and all of a sudden, it's a 2-1 deficit for the Jets that turns into a 3-2 lead, really in a blink of an eye. I mean, the Bruins fell asleep for 90 seconds, and that's all it took for Kyle Connor to really put the Jets on his back offensively and give the Jets the lead. But Sean, I mean, I don't usually point to fights as a turning point, but I thought the two fights late in the second period, Adam Lowry and Brandon Tanev both dropping the gloves, gave the Jets a bit of a boost. I usually don't say that there's a connection between the two, but in this instance, the Jets sort of woke up at that point in time, and it had been a slumber that had been almost five periods long, dating back to the Philadelphia game on Monday. I thought those fights gave the Jets a little bit of energy heading into the third period.
Totally. I mean, I'm not exactly as well as you, Drew, a supporter of, you know, the fisticuffs anymore. I think it's a little bit outdated and a little bit barbaric, but yeah, it seemed to spark the team, and it was just really interesting to see kind of the circumstances of said fights. I mean, Brandon Tanev gets laid out at the blue line and without even any hesitation, Adam Lowry just, I believe it was Brandon Carlo, I could be wrong about that, but stares him down. You just hear him say, no, let's go. And off to the races they go. And then Brandon Tanevs is a little bit funnier. He kind of finds Trent Frederick in the pile. I think he took a bit of a high stick from him earlier in the play and kind of drags him away from Tyler Myers. And then the awkward high five from Trent Frederick's parents in the stands. And what?
I never know what your reaction is as parents. If you're watching your son.
It's got to be just
in like bare knuckle fighting. And I know it's his first NHL game, so they're excited. But it's
weird to watch.
Is a high five the sort of thing you do when you watch your kid?
Two parents?
Yeah, fighting each other? I mean, it's always awkward.
I don't know if it's awkward, Drew.
Do you think the primo parents were high fiving each other when Wayne and Keith dropped the gloves against each other back in the day?
That's a different situation because brothers were fighting, right? So I don't know who you're cheering for there, right? Like who are you cheering for? Does the mom take Wayne and then the dad takes Keith?
I don't know.
But I think you're just happy that
he made it out of the fight.
Let's be honest. I love Brandon Tanev, but he lost that fight.
Yeah, of course.
Trent Frederick won that fight, and obviously you don't get any points for winning a fight. But you mentioned it. That was Frederick's first NHL game, right? So pretty gutsy in your first NHL game to fight because it was a close game, right?
Did have the height and size advantage. So it's not like he was, Tanev did pick out a rookie, but he picked out a rookie who's bigger than him. So I suppose the code was followed, whatever the code might be.
Right. The point is, though, it was a chippy game, and you almost got the feeling that there was going to be a fight. And I agree with Sean. I mean, fighting has been down year over year for quite some time now. Fighting is just not as big of a part of the game as it was in the late 1980s into the late 90s and early 2000s, right? So obviously fighting is eventually going to go the way of the dodo bird, right? And I'm a type of guy that loves fighting, but it just doesn't have a place like it used to. So I like the fights, didn't have a problem with it. And you also saw Jake DeBrusk and Brendan Lemieux going at it.
Yeah.
That's what I was going to go with that after.
Right.
After Brandon Tanev's fight, DeBrusk and Lemieux were kind of, they were going at it throughout the entire game. I mean, Jake DeBrusk almost steamrolled Connor Hellebuck, and Hellebuck gives him the stare down. We've talked about Hellebuck not being quite appreciative of guys crashing the crease. We talked about, I believe, last Wednesday, but maybe making it a little bit more
restrictive.
You penalize the more players if they touch the crease. But first of all, that was a great stare down by Connor Hellebuck. But you watch the two and they lined up at the faceoff together. I'm thinking they're going to go. These two guys are going to go. There's going to be a third fight within a matter of minutes. But cooler heads prevailed. We'll see.
It's got to be a blow to the Boston Bruins. I mean, obviously, they thought they had that game in control, and they did for a large portion of it. But to lose the game on two Kyle Connor goals when you passed on Connor three separate times to take guys who are really not significant contributors to your lineup, it's sort of an extra special blow to the Bruins' ego last night. And Don Sweeney, Bruins' general manager, has to be sitting up in the general manager suite saying, we could have had this guy and we passed on them three different times and this is really biting us in the behind tonight.
That was there was one of two top topics on Twitter last night. There was Kyle Connor sticking it to the team that could have drafted him, and then Patrick Laine.
Well, let's talk about
10 minutes of ice time, zero shot attempts.
So let's talk about Patrick Laine's game last night. As was that rock bottom for Patrick Laine? I mean, and it's hard to give that answer, but given all the sort of trials and tribulations he's been through since becoming a member of the Jets, since really in this last, say, 6 to 8 weeks, besides the month of November this year, was that sort of as at least that second period, because I thought he was a little more noticeable in the third period, but was that as poor an effort as we've seen from Patrick Laine?
Maybe. I mean, it has to be degrading, though, for Patty Laine to only play 2 minutes in the second period, right? I mean, you're just not used to playing those types of minutes. And when you're talking about his game, I mean, I think we've seen a continuation of the struggles of Patrick Laine here over the last couple of games since the All-Star break. And you were thinking maybe guys that, the All-Star break would do him favors and he'd get to step away from the game. I'm not even sure if Laine left Winnipeg or if he went on a trip, but I'm sure that, I wouldn't be surprised if he did go on a trip. So
most of the guys did.
Right. So you were hoping that, he was going to be able to clear his head, but he certainly didn't play well yesterday. I mean, Patrick Laine, he had a few opportunities. I don't even remember how many shots he had. Maybe only one shot on net.
Zero.
Did he have zero?
Zero shot attempts.
Zero shot attempts.
Zero shot attempts. Zero shots on goal. Just a real, useless stat line for Patrick Laine.
Right. And it feels like we've been talking about this now for 2 months, guys. And it doesn't seem like anybody has the answers here. And, you know, when you're talking about Line A, you don't expect to see him on the fourth line, but you wonder what's going to happen here Thursday night. Does Paul Maurice go back to Brian Little and Patrick Line A and Jack Roslovic? That's what I expect to happen on Thursday night, tomorrow night versus Columbus. But you wonder, the way he played in December with 19 goals or 18 goals, whatever it
November.
Was. November with the 18 goals or 19 goals. I mean, you really wonder, you know, what's it going to take for him to get his game back? Because it's not just the goal scoring. For me, what concerns me the most is his play away from the puck. And he just doesn't seem to be motivated right now. And a lot of people are questioning, you know, his work ethic and all of that. But it's unquestionable that he's struggling. And that's in all facets of the game. So I don't think that he's going to be demoted to the fourth line. I think many people, you know, are calling for Line A to be demoted. I just don't know if that happens.
Ted Wyman of the Winnipeg Sun in his column said that it's time for him to be a healthy scratch for a game. Agree? Disagree? I mean, you know, what's going to snap him out of that? What's going to make him realize the effort that needs to go in, shift out, to be an effective NHL player?
Listen, I don't think it's... Will it benefit Patrick Laine to sit in the press box for a game? Probably. Will it happen? Probably not. However, I will say this. The guy does need to start moving his feet. He needs to drive those legs. Paul Maurice says it all the time. The legs are the driving force to whether you can have a successful game or not. If the legs are moving, everything else will follow. And he just looks like a guy who's mentally battling it. He looks unsure of himself. Especially on the wall. You can see the indecisiveness on the wall when he's trying to break out. He doesn't know where to look. He's flipping just a lot of the flip pucks into the neutral zone. So you see that he doesn't have a direct vision of what he wants to do with the play. He's got to get going. To say other people need to get him going is unfair to the other players on the Jets. And to put him on the fourth line, I believe, is also unfair because the fourth line is playing great right now. They're providing valuable minutes, offensive zone time, and do you want to disrupt that just to get... I mean, you would want to disrupt that to get Patrick
Laine
going.
If it was to get him going, but there's no guarantee it would work.
But exactly, that's the thing. If it goes on 10 more games and you've broken up a fourth line that was so valuable, I just think of the Nashville game right off the top of my head. I mean, it's a tough, tough ask.
Yeah, and that's just not how you're going to use Patrick Laine, right? I mean, Patrick Laine is a dangerous offensive weapon. You're not going to use him on the fourth line.
And
you have, you know, dangerous offensive players on that fourth line right now, I think. I mean, Mason Appleton is a dangerous offensive player.
They've certainly been more
player.
Noticeable, more effective.
Right, but, you know, if you put Patrick Laine on the fourth line, are you doing that to send him a message? Are you doing that to get him going? As far as sitting him out, making him a healthy scratch, I agree with Sean. Who knows what it'll do? It'll probably help him in the long run, but it doesn't really matter what we think, right? I mean, that decision ultimately comes up to Paul Maurice.
Certainly
right?
Does.
So, I mean, I would say, yes, sure, make him a healthy scratch maybe the way he's been playing. I agree with Shawnee. I just don't see that happening right now. And, you know, when you talk about, you know, who Line A should be playing with, he's too good of an offensive player, guys, to not be on a top two line. I mean, Frank Zappia, our really good friend, has been calling for Patrick Laine to be on the top line with Mark Scheifele and Blake Wheeler. We've talked about this for years now. I mean, that's just something that Paul Maurice is hesitant to do right now, on the left side with Mark Scheifele and Blake Wheeler. So it's a conundrum right now. It really is. How do you get Patrick Laine going? I mean, I don't know if anybody has the answer to that.
I don't know either, and I suspect we'll probably be talking about it on Saturday's show as well.
This was a guy that earlier in the season, in November, do you guys remember when he scored 5 goals in a game?
Yeah,
of course.
I mean, at one point in the season, he was on pace for 70 goals.
71 goals. He's now on pace for 41
71,
goals.
Sure, Drew.
I mean, your point is that he was on pace for, you know, to score an exorbitant a number of goals.
He's not even on pace for 50 now.
He's on pace for 41 right now. I mean, he's absolutely still a good number.
Yeah.
But the way, I mean, looking at that number and how you come to it, you can say that, you know, he's only been effective for how many of the 82 games in the season? At a point in time, who are you without, you know, otherwise?
And I like the fact that Maurice benched him. Because it shows the fact that the coaching staff is willing to now take some punitive measures with this guy. Not just coddle him and cradle him anymore. Now you're here. You've established yourself, and now it's time to get your acting gear.
And that's why, Shawnee, I think it's a little ridiculous to... And I'm not saying what Ted Wyman said is ridiculous. I'm saying it's a little bit ridiculous to think that Paul Maurice is going to make him a healthy scratch, because I think he already sent that message by sitting him in the second period.
When we come back, we talk about the Jets-Blue Jackets game tomorrow evening and the Blue Jackets with a load of decisions to make ahead of the trade deadline, with Artemi Panarin announcing he will not negotiate a contract extension until July 1st. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast,
on TSN1290.ca.
And I'll just cut to the chase. Disappointment on your behalf that Panarin has shown an unwillingness to extend here.
We just go about our business. Yeah, we, as I said all along, this has been around us all year long, and we get ready to play Buffalo tonight. I know he's going to be ready to play. Yeah, we just go about our business.
Columbus Blue Jackets are into Winnipeg tomorrow night. That was Blue Jackets head coach John Tortorella. He was asked earlier this week to respond to the statement that was released by Artemi Panarin's agent, Dan Milstein. Basically, the statement said, "We're not negotiating a contract extension. Panarin becomes a UFA on July 1st. The Blue Jackets will be in a position where they either have to trade him at the trade deadline or likely will have to lose him for nothing come July 1st. That was John Tortorella responding to, you know, how they're approaching that now that they know it's out in the open. Welcome back to NHL This Week. This segment of the show is brought to you by Dr. Les Rikus and the team at Linden Market Dental Center. Dr. Rikus and his team provide modern and comprehensive dental care for the whole family. To make an appointment today, visit LindenMarketDentalCenter.com. You know, I got to tell you, Ez and Sean, that I've really appreciated all season long how John Tortorella has handled the litany of questions that he's received about Panarin and Bobrovsky.
I agree, and you're not being sarcastic.
I'm not being sarcastic at all. I think he has handled it just, never mind that he hasn't snapped, because everyone sort of expects that Tortorella is going to be his gruff, snappy self. But the way he's approached it from keeping the team unified in the dressing room. He said, you know, those guys are professionals. They've earned the right to become unrestricted free agents. Whatever they do, it's not going to affect this dressing room. This dressing room is almost off limits for those conversations. Jarmo Kekalainen, the general manager, is going to handle it however he handles it. Whatever he does that he thinks is best for the team. I'm going to coach the guys in front of me, and I'm going to make sure they're ready, and I'm going to make sure Panarin is ready. And I appreciate that. It's a very difficult situation that the Blue Jackets are in, but I think Tortorella himself, from the head coaching perspective, has handled it really well this year.
Yeah, I agree. And it's a difficult situation for so many reasons, right, guys? The Blue Jackets are only 4 points out of first in the Metro Division. We thought the Metro Division would be a lot stronger this year. Nobody thought that the Islanders were going to be leading the Metro right now. And I personally think by the time this is all said and done, Washington's going to be leading the division, but that's just me personally. But right now it's completely up for grabs, right? So not only can Columbus be a playoff team, they could, in theory, finish first or second in the division. And there's no reason why that can't happen, right? We mentioned Washington right now is in second. They're only 1 point up on Columbus. So it's such a difficult decision, because you obviously risk losing both Artemi Panarin and Sergei Bobrovsky for nothing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you also risk the future, possibly, right? And we saw this last year, guys, if you remember, with Matt Calvert and Jack Johnson.
Yeah.
Right? Many people thought Matt Calvert and or Jack Johnson was going to be traded.
Mm-hmm.
Because with all of those good young defensemen, right? Seth Jones, Zach Werenski, Marcus Nutavara, all these guys.
Jack Johnson had been
expendable.
He would drop to a bottom pairing role, if not a healthy scratch for the
Blue
Jackets.
And they didn't want to pay him whatever he got in Pittsburgh, $5 million a year.
Mm-hmm.
And the same thing goes for Matt Calvert, right? They have other guys that have passed him on the depth chart, and that's why he ended up signing elsewhere. So if you're Jarmo Kekalainen, I really, you know, and we're going to ask Aaron Portsline, he's coming up next, but we're going to ask Aaron what you would do if you were Jarmo Kekalainen, but I don't even think Jarmo knows, because you have a player right now, and we all know who's number one on the trade bait board right now. It's the bread man, Artemi Panarin.
Yeah.
And if you're a team that is looking for that player to put you over to the top, Shawnee, right? So if you're a team like Nashville, or if you're, let's say, the Boston Bruins, I mean, there's a bunch of teams that would look at Artemi Panarin and they'd say, or Colorado, and he could be a rental. I mean, the Islanders are also rumored to be in there because apparently he wants to be either in the New York area, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, Panarin might get traded there and they might end up signing him. So it becomes more difficult because if you're a team trying to acquire a guy like Panarin, what are you going to give up? Is it going to be a couple of prospects and a first-round pick, or is it going to be a roster player and a first-round pick?
Well, if you feel as though you can, if you feel as though you have a legitimate shot at re-signing him,
yep.
And let's say the Islanders.
Yep.
So maybe the Islanders are a little more interested in, or a little more willing to pay a heavier price,
right.
Because as by trading for him, you can offer him that eighth year.
Yep.
So there is a bit of an extra incentive from an Islanders perspective or a team's perspective that really feels as though they have an opportunity to get him when he hits free agency or prevent him from even getting to free agency.
Right, and I want to get Shawnee in here because I've been talking way too much. But
yeah, that's going on 10 years now, though.
And the other thing that makes this more difficult is if you're Jarmo Kekäläinen, you have to nail this trade. Because you know that your team has a decent chance. It's wide open, guys.
Sure.
It really is. I mean, the Stanley Cup, almost every year we say this, but it really is wide open. With the exception of the Lightning, the Jets, the Flames, and the Predators, I mean, there aren't that many elite teams.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I obviously, you know, expect the Jets to go far and the Lightning to go far, but if you're the Blue Jackets, especially in that division, you have a really good chance to at least go to the second round, something they've never done. So Kekäläinen has to nail it if he decides to trade Panarin, right? He has to get a player that can, at the very least, Drew, replace that offense.
What I like about Kekäläinen, and you mentioned Jack Johnson last year, Ezzy, Kekäläinen said that my asking price for Jack Johnson is a first-round pick. And he never got that first-round pick. So rather than changing his asking price, he said, okay, I'm just going to hold on to the player. I'll use him in the playoffs for whatever value he provided the team come playoff time and for the final, you know, 6 weeks of the regular season. And he said he didn't make any panicky moves because the offers weren't coming in.
Yep.
So I think he's going to do the same thing. I imagine that he will say, this is what I want. If you want, you know, this is what I'm going to need in return. If you want to acquire Panarin, this is what I'm going to need in return. If you want to acquire Bobrovsky. And he's going to stick to his guns because we've seen history where he does stick to his guns. And, you know, is it a blow to the organization to lose a guy like Panarin or a guy like Bobrovsky for nothing in return? Sure it is. But at the same time, it's also sending a pretty good message, you know, to your dressing room that we still believe in you for the rest of this season. We're just going to let it ride. I wasn't going to sell ourselves short and accept, you know, 75 cents on the dollar. We're going to keep the player and we're going to drive him into the playoffs.
Well, I think the playoffs is the key word there. And I think Ezzy touched on it perfectly there with the uncertainty regarding the future of these two players. I mean, right now, the Columbus Blue Jackets, they need a series win in the playoffs. They
yes.
need that revenue. They need that. They need to shed the monkey off their back with regards to not having a. They need to give the fans the opportunity to see their team progress. A good team that's playing good hockey progress into the second round. Can they do that without their starting goaltender? I mean, Jonas Korpisalo has been playing admirably.
Did you watch Bobrovsky last night? I know it's only one game against the Sabres, but did you watch Bobrovsky last night?
Not good.
Not good is an understatement for his performance. So, I mean, you know, Panarin has been bringing it still. Panarin's having a pretty good year.
You think Bobrovsky's maybe checked out?
I think Bobrovsky checked out
in Tampa Bay.
In Tampa Bay, where the suspension occurred.
I was at that game.
There you go. So, I mean, I think Bobrovsky, if you look at how they're performing right now, Panarin is still doing yeoman's work for the Blue Jackets. I mean, he's a key member of that team. He leads the team in points. 55 points. He's over a point a game. He's a superstar. Right now, Bobrovsky, the way he's been playing this year for the Columbus Blue Jackets, is not a superstar.
I don't think Bobrovsky is going to be... How many teams want Bobrovsky?
None.
Because think about it.
No team is good. Yeah.
If you want Bobrovsky, you're a team that is either solidly in a playoff spot or going to the playoffs.
Yeah.
Has a chance, right? And Bobrovsky's track record in the playoffs has been awful.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, Bobrovsky, I just don't have confidence in Bobrovsky in the playoffs. He's been a great regular season goaltender. He's won the Vezina Trophy. You know, getting back to potential trades, you know, and Shawnee, you know, you were agreeing with me when I said, you know, that the Columbus Blue Jackets want to go far and almost have to go far in this year's playoffs. If you're talking about a team like the Islanders,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you're not asking for Josh Hosang in return. I think you're asking for a guy like Anders Lee.
Oh, and why would the Islanders do that?
Well, because they're getting Artemi Panarin.
Well, sorry, for Panarin. I thought you meant for Bobrovsky.
I'm talking about... You have to be getting back a legitimate top six forward
sure.
for Artemi Panarin. And we'll ask Aaron Portsline about it coming up. But, you know, Lee, you're talking about a 40-goal scorer. I agree with you. I mean, Panarin is a guy, I think, that... His best offensive years, I don't think, have come yet.
Oh, I think the future is so bright for Artemi Panarin. I mean, this is a, I mean, that trade from the, that sent him from Chicago to Columbus is a horrible trade.
Yes.
I mean, Brandon Saad, even if, you know, it was probably the Blue Jackets, even if Brandon Saad was still a high quality NHL player, the Blue Jackets were acquiring the better player in that deal from day one.
Right.
And sure, that had to do with some of the salary cap issues and everything else going on in Chicago, but Artemi Panarin has never shown anything other than being a bona fide NHL superstar with over a point per game talent. So, I mean, if you're the Blue Jackets, you really are going to have to be blown out of the water, I think, you know, in trading him away. You're going to have to get a guy who's going to step into your lineup and be a member of your team for the next 3, 4, 5, 6 years and be a top six player, no questions asked.
Right, and that's why it's hard to know, guys, if Jarmo Kekalainen's going to make the move. Right now, I would say it's kind of 50-50. I mean, I could see Panarin staying with Columbus, and I could see them trading him easily.
It all depends, I think, on how big the offer is.
Yeah, I was going to say, it all depends on the return.
That's right. Yep. And he's not going to sell it for 75 cents on the dollar. When we come back, more on the Blue Jackets. They're in town tomorrow to play the Jets. Aaron Portsline covers the team for TheAthletic.com. We'll talk to Aaron up next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour, welcome back to NHL This Week. Drew Mandel, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. It's hashtag Bell Let's Talk Day. Make sure you keep using that hashtag up until midnight. It's going to keep the funds rolling in, just, you know, raising money for some great causes. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Our website is IllegalCurve.com. And let's head to the Hockey Show Hotline.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
From TheAthletic.com, we're pleased to welcome to the program Aaron Portsline. Aaron, quite a coincidence that the temperature hits, you know, minus 14 million, and you are avoiding this road trip into Winnipeg.
I can assure you, Tom Reed, my great colleague, asked to go to Winnipeg yet again, and we agreed in August when, frankly, this kind of weather sounded like a really good idea back in August.
Yeah. Well, then, you know, to the victor go the spoils. In this case, we're going to declare you the victor. Obviously brought you on to talk about the Blue Jackets ahead of the game tomorrow evening here in Winnipeg. You know, last segment we were talking, we played a clip of John Tortorella, and it was right after, I think, you asked him about sort of the reaction to Dan Milstein and Artemi Panarin's coming out with agent coming out with the statement saying there's not going to be any more negotiations. And I was impressed with how Tortorella sort of handled the drama around Panarin and around Bobrovsky all season long, sort of walling off the team and walling off the dressing room from the, let's say, the general manager's duties of trying to get these guys signed under contract. You know, being there on the ground, how do you think Tortorella has handled this situation, this unique situation this year?
Well, I think he's handled it really well. I think the players deserve a lot of credit for the way that they've handled it, too. They're right in the middle of the metro. They've lost three in a row. It's the first time they've lost three straight all season, so they've been pretty consistent in that respect. I think the one thing he's done, and he's talked a little bit about this, is they have been very open and out front and public, not with us, but among themselves in the dressing room, where before the season started, the whole team got together and they talked about what was coming. They knew this was going to be a distraction. When Sergei Bobrovsky did what he did in Tampa a few weeks ago and was suspended a game for it, he apologized not just to the coaches in a room, but he talked to the entire team, the coaches and the management together. Just yesterday before a morning skate, they had a team meeting where they talked about what Panarin's agent said the night before and what that meant. So it's all out there. No one's talking behind anybody else's back. No one's tap dancing around issues. I like the fact that they haven't acted like there's nothing going on, like a lot of coaches tend to do, just another day, because it's not just another day when these things happen. But they've also told the players that they're not free to talk about this, which is a little unusual for adult players, professionals, to agree to something entirely like that. I think they have a lot to say, the players, but perhaps they'll have more to say when this comes to a head, maybe in a month or so.
Aaron, how hard is this decision for Jarmo Kekalainen? We knew this was coming. You know, you talked about it, and last time we had you on, we asked you about Panarin, and I'm sure every time you're on a radio station or TV station, you're talking about Artemi Panarin specifically and Sergei Bobrovsky. But how hard is it for Kekalainen right now? Because now we're less than a month from the trade deadline, and he has to decide, is he going to keep Panarin for the playoff run or risk losing him for nothing?
Yeah, and it's similar to Bob, although Bob has the no move, so he could stop a trade. But, you know, he has before him some pretty weighty decisions here. I think it's difficult, sure. It's also what these guys sign up for. I think more than difficult is it has the potential to be very confusing. Does he let Panarin and or Bobrovsky negotiate with a team that he may be able to land a trade with? Does he keep one and not the other? Does he have to get a goaltender back for Bobrovsky? Does he have to get a scoring forward back for Panarin? Or can there be subsequent moves to patch the holes that would be created by those moves, Bobrovsky and Panarin leaving? Are there going to be sort of conditional trades where Panarin is traded to a team that thinks they can re-sign him but isn't sure, and Columbus gets this, this, and this on the 25th or before, and if the team signs him, then they also get this? I think you could very well see a trade like that. There are a ton of moving parts here. And the other thing for Kekalainen is, if he moves Panarin and all he can get are futures, in other words, prospects, picks, and the like, he's also going to pull subsequent trades to replace or try to replace, at least in some portion, the offense that Panarin brings. Same with the goaltender. If Bobrovsky moves out, they have to bring somebody in that can support or be the number one ahead of Korpisalo. So there's so many different variables here of trades that could beget other trades, that could beget other moves, that those are the things that I think that keep him up juggling ideas at night right now.
Aaron, I'm curious, what is the level of urgency in Columbus with regards to, I don't want to say playoff success, but a series win or, you know, a little bit of success in the postseason?
Well, it's a good question because I think people are sort of batting this around too. Like, what if they just kept both of these guys and said, we're going to see how far we can go in the playoffs? And then you go, okay, well, that's cool. Like, that's fun to talk about if you're not the GM, maybe. But what does it say? What would be acceptable in the postseason? What would be an acceptable level of success in the postseason to justify letting a two-time Vezina Trophy goalie and a point-a-game forward leave with nothing in return? I think you also have to look at it almost audaciously for a team that's never won a first-round series. Can this team win a Stanley Cup? Can they? If you look at the other teams in the East, and they get past Washington, Pittsburgh, Tampa, Toronto? I don't know. I don't think so. But this is why we have sports and we play games, is because there's great drama there. If you think they can do that, then go for it. I think that's a reach. I think most people looking at this team would think that that is a reach. And so, there is pressure to win a playoff series, absolutely. I also think people will understand that Jarmo Kekalainen has had his hands tied to an extent here, and there's nothing wrong with him trading these guys for the best that he can do and moving forward in a way that's best for the organization long-term, not just specifically 2018-19.
Aaron Portsline is our guest on NHL This Week. Aaron, of course, covers the Columbus Blue Jackets for TheAthletic.com. Aaron, we've talked a lot about the goaltending. Who do you expect it to be in net tomorrow night in Winnipeg? It was Bobrovsky last night against the Sabres. Wasn't a great performance. Does Tortorella go back with him tomorrow night? Or do you think we see Jonas Korpisalo in Winnipeg tomorrow night?
So I don't really know the answer for sure. They have not said for sure who's starting. My guess is that it's Korpisalo, but I literally just typed the line before I picked up the phone with you guys, that right now John Tortorella is throwing change-ups and we're swinging at fastballs because I can't read it right now. Usually you get into a rhythm where you know where you have a good idea of where it's going with the guy. He's got everybody off balance with the goaltending choice. But I think it's Korpisalo because I think they want to take a look at him and they want to see him in difficult situations and see if he can be the guy that they can lean on should Bobrovsky leave town.
Well, to that point, from your perspective, from what you've seen of him for the last couple of years, do you think he can be that guy?
Well, he's been really good here the last couple of weeks. He started four of the six games before the deadline, and he looked really, really good. I think I am. I know enough about goaltending to know that I don't know enough about goaltending, if that makes any sense.
It does.
That position is so unpredictable and so it's incredible to me through the years how many great stories there are of goalies who have gone on runs and have never done it before, or goalies that have who have just exploded 4 or 5 years into their career and were fine from there. He has all the potential in the world, Korpisalo does, but there have been great inconsistencies through the years. Maybe, in fairness to him, maybe that changes if he knows when he's playing regularly and gets a proper workload for a goalie. I think the jury is still out, but I think there have been really positive signs for him in the last month.
Aaron, we've asked you about Alex Wennberg many times over the years. I almost want to say we've asked you about him half a dozen times over the years, and it might be because he was a former first-round pick selected right after Josh Morrissey in the 2013 draft. And I remember back in New Jersey, you know, there was the question of whether the Jets were going to draft Alex Wennberg, and he had that career year 2 years ago with 59 points, but he's still stuck on one goal. How important are the next 30 games for Wennberg, and do you think that could possibly impact whether or not he's going to be around long-term with Columbus?
Well, he's such a difficult player, and there's so much frustration around him. John Tortorella, without naming Wennberg, mentioned upon the hiring of Martin St. Louis as a consultant that there are guys on this roster that he has been unable to reach. I cannot imagine that Alexander Wennberg is not the guy he's talking about. One goal in the last 50-plus games for him. We were joking when they hired St. Louis. St. Louis is only one goal behind Wennberg this year. It's incredible to me, and I hesitate to be too critical of him because I wonder how much of it is a reluctance on his part to really be in an involved player that plays without worry. I think he's had at least two concussions. He suffered an awful hit from Tom Wilson in the playoffs last year. It wasn't the same after that. No suspension called on that one. And I think he's backpedaled because of it. I think he is a perimeter player. He is a source of great frustration. It's funny, people keep saying, "Well, you know, maybe it's time to trade him." Well, I'm not sure where the line forms for a center that used to put up points but hasn't for 2 years and is a solid defensive player, a really good penalty killer, but is making over $4 million a year on a guaranteed contract for the next few years. Teams don't typically line up for those guys, so I think they're holding on to him because they're holding on to hope that he can rediscover where he was 2 years ago when he looked like a budding number one center.
Aaron, Boone Jenner didn't make the trip to Winnipeg, and then you've seen some of the transactions that the team has made. They've called up Mark Letestu. Winnipeggers know Mark Letestu quite well. Every time he played them as an Oiler, he would score multiple, at least one goal against the Jets. So,
nice.
Yeah, super nice. So should Jets fans maybe be a little worried if Mark Letestu is going to suit up for the Columbus Blue Jackets, or do you expect him to realistically be in the lineup?
You know, I think he does draw in because they played so poorly in against Buffalo the other night. He's called up to be the extra guy on the trip, but I wouldn't be surprised at all if he drew in. I mean, you look up and down the middle of their lineup. You just asked about Wennberg. And the frustration doesn't stop there at that position. Riley Nash, who they signed as a free agent, which I thought was a heck of a signing, barely been able to hold down the fourth line. They would like for him to be able to play higher in the lineup. He's not been able to. So they even had Lucas Sedlak playing essentially in the third line role yesterday with Jenner out. That's not ideal. I think Letestu goes in there. I think they move Riley Nash up. I think Letestu plays a sort of a fourth line role. They've had Brandon Dubinsky playing mostly on the wing this year rather than at center ice. So it's really unsettled, and you hate to put it all on one guy, but if Alexander Wennberg were able to be at least even a number two center behind Pierre-Luc Dubois, well, the Blue Jackets would I think, align much easier. Boone Jenner would be back on the wing again, and things would be more normal. But they have been in sort of CYA mode here because that center ice position has been such a struggle for them.
Aaron Portsline of TheAthletic.com is our guest on NHL This Week. Aaron, last question for you. Cam Atkinson is on the verge, should certainly set career highs in goals this year for the Blue Jackets. He's at 28 goals already. Career high was 35 2 years ago. What has changed this year that's allowed him to recapture and exceed that goal total that's making him close to a 40 or over 40 goal per season guy this year?
Yeah, well, he started, if you look at his numbers, and I don't have the date in front of me, but it would have been in January last year. He came back from a broken foot in Las Vegas. And on that night, they put Pierre-Luc Dubois with Atkinson and Panarin. And since then, Cam Atkinson is a top five goal scorer in the league. He has two guys with him that are pretty good playmakers. Dubois is more of a strong shooting type than less of a playmaker, I think, in most people's eyes. But he can whirl the puck around. And Panarin loves to pass first. And I think Atkinson has learned to play with those guys. And the one thing that Atkinson does, and it is a talent, is he gets lost on the ice. People forget about him. He's slippery. He goes to places where people can lose him. And I think he's playing with perfect guys to be that kind of player, because when Panarin is on the ice, he likes to have the puck. And when he has the puck, he has everybody's attention. And that allows Cam Atkinson to get lost. And the one, I think he's managed his emotions better. He used to be a player that when he missed a golden scoring opportunity, you knew that that stick was not going to make it back to the bench or too far past it before he destroyed it. He would vent. He would become this sort of ball of frustration, and then it would only get worse for him. He has leveled off that way. I think he's just really found a home with his line mates and is really accepting a role of a guy that's a top-line player and is expected to score big goals.
Aaron Portsline covers the Columbus Blue Jackets for TheAthletic.com. Aaron, always appreciate your time and insight. Thanks so much for joining us this evening.
Okay, guys. Thanks for having me.
Take care, Aaron. When we come back, the Maple Leafs have made the first big splash around NHL trade deadline, acquiring Jake Muzzin from the Kings. We talk about that trade. We declare a winner, a loser, or are they both winners, or are they both losers? We're really willing to hand out any sort of grade here on NHL This Week. You're listening to TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Toronto Maple Leafs, clearly. I mean, this is a 500-foot upper deck home run by Cal Dubas and the Toronto Maple Leafs. This is exactly what they needed, a defenseman that can play almost 22 minutes a game. He penalty kills. He plays on the power play. And when you consider what they didn't give up, nobody off their team, and they give up a third-line player in Grundstrom, an offensive type in Durzi, and a first-round draft pick, they have maximized their opportunity this year.
TSN Director of Scouting Craig Button giving his analysis of the trade from earlier this week. The Maple Leafs acquiring Jake Muzzin from the LA Kings in exchange for Carl Grundstrom, a former second-round pick of the Leafs. Sean Durzi, who is an unsigned former second-round pick defenseman of the Leafs. And the upcoming 2019 first-round pick. High praise from Craig Button there, saying it's a 500-foot home run for the Maple Leafs. You know, on the surface, it seems like a pretty good trade for the Leafs, giving up two players, two prospects who aren't what I'm going to describe as top-line prospects in their system, and a first-round pick that is going to come somewhere between 20 and 30 at this upcoming NHL draft.
Right, and I don't know if I would call it a home run for the Leafs, but I think it's a great trade for the Leafs, guys, and I also think it's a pretty good trade for the Kings. And, you know, you mentioned that these aren't top prospects in the Flames system. The top two prospects, top two D prospects, when you're talking about Timothy Liljegren and Rasmus Sandin, right, you're talking about guys that they expect to be in the NHL a couple of years from now, right? Kind of taking that Josh Morrissey type of development in the American Hockey League. But when you're talking about Carl Grundstrom and you're talking about Sean Durzi, both second-round picks, and when you're talking about Grundstrom, I think he's got 29 points in the American Hockey League for the Marlies. So you're not talking about a couple of slouches. You're talking about future prospects. So, you know, if you're Rob Blake and you look at your team and you're in last place, you kind of look at Jake Muzzin and you say, okay, well, why are we hanging on to a guy like Muzzin when we know we're not going to be good not only this year, we're not going to be good probably next year and the year after. So I actually think Rob Blake did pretty well.
Well, two questions or two comments about what you just said. First of all, apparently the Kings, according to Elliot Friedman's 31 Thoughts today, the Kings have the choice to choose between Timothy Liljegren and Sean Durzi, and they chose Durzi over Liljegren. Liljegren's stock, if you remember, he was supposed to be a top five pick the year he was drafted, and his stock fell that year later on into the first round.
Right, but I think the reason why Leafs fans are happy that Liljegren wasn't traded is because Durzi's in the Ontario Hockey League.
Sure.
Durzi's only 20 years old.
And he's unsigned.
You mentioned he's unsigned. Mm-hmm. He was a guy that was drafted after not being drafted in the 2017 draft. So Durzi's a guy that the Kings hope is going to turn into something one day.
Absolutely.
Obviously, they're not penciling him into the NHL next year. But back to Jake Muzzin,
I have one more question for you first. You talked that you liked the return that Rob Blake got. Why did he make this trade, what I'm going to describe as so early? I mean, obviously it's not so early, but if you're Rob Blake, and this offer from the Leafs is probably going to be there for the next 2 or 3 weeks, it's not like this offer was really going to change dramatically, I don't believe. Why don't you sort of do the long play, the slow play on this one, and see if another team gets more desperate? Maybe you play the Leafs off of another team to try and increase the bid. I was a little surprised that they went so quickly with this deal, given that it doesn't include an active NHL player. I think if I was Rob Blake and this is the deal that I wanted to accept, I would have waited a little while longer to consummate the deal and see if I could get a bidding war going.
Love the bidding war. We all love a good bidding war. However, I will say this. We had Darren Dreger on the station earlier today, and he said, guys, don't be surprised if the LA Kings aren't done making some big moves.
Certainly.
So maybe you get a deal that you like. You've got a few other deals that you maybe have to check off the list, and you can just kind of get the ball rolling, get the wheels in motion right now. Maybe it's dependent. Another deal is dependent on someone you're getting back from the Maple Leafs. Who knows? We're not in the office of Rob Blake, but what we do know and what our insiders have been telling us is that the Kings are not done. So maybe they just wanted to get a head start on the market, jump out early, deal Jake Muzzin for some prospective prospects and picks, and then kind of move forward from there, assessing whatever is left of your roster, and then moving forward.
Shawnee, for the Kings, it's all about the cap space.
Right? And clear some cap space,
right? Muzzin's making $4 million this year and next year, so they go from having 3-point-something in cap space to now they have $7 million in cap space. And when Shawnee talks about, you know, what Darren Dreger said and the Kings possibly having more tricks up their sleeve, why wouldn't you create more cap room, right? If you see Erik Karlsson out there in the summer, if you see a guy like Artemi Panarin.
That's the name I was going to use. Right? For a team that's desperate for offense.
So the Kings, you know, I don't think, I've mentioned this to you before, Drew, I don't think the Kings are as bad off as some people think. Do I think they're going to be a Stanley Cup contender next year? No, I don't. But when you talk about, you know, some of their core pieces, you know, Anže Kopitar might be a little older. He's in his early 30s now.
Yeah, he's 31 right now.
But I think the Kings, with a couple of smart moves a couple of years from now, when you look at some of the prospects they have in their system, I think they're actually going to be pretty good. But when you get back to Jake Muzzin, and by the way, it's amazing that they're already talking about whether or not Muzzin can play on the right side with Morgan Rielly, because
he's already slotted in the lineup according to Daily Faceoff on the top line.
And if you're going to play with Morgan Rielly, Morgan Riley's a left-shot defenseman, but so is Muzzin.
Did you hear what Daryl Sutter said? I mean, Daryl Sutter came out and said, you know, anybody who's saying that Jake Muzzin has played on the right side is lying. He's never played a game on his right side in his life, is basically what Daryl Sutter said.
No, he's played with Drew Doughty.
And the Leafs are saying
that
he's comfortable playing on the right side. So it's kind of a war of words right now. It's pretty fun to watch.
And that's, you know, and why this is a win for Toronto and I think a win for LA is because what has Toronto needed for 2 years now? They've needed a guy like a Jake Muzzin. Now, Jake Muzzin is not a top five defenseman in the NHL, but he's a very serviceable solid defensive defenseman. He's got a big body. He's physical, but he can also chip in offense. He's got that offensive touch. Now, you know, he's not maybe the 40-point defenseman that he used to be, but he's a guy that makes them better on either the left side or the right side, and it allows Ron Hainsey to now be a third-pairing defenseman. Ron Hainsey, at the ripe old age of 37, he shouldn't be a top-four defenseman. Certainly. He's better suited to play with Travis Dermott, right? Mm-hmm. So this makes the Leafs a better team now, and it makes the Kings a better team down the road.
I'm interested to see how that left-right dynamic plays out in Toronto. I mean, can Morgan Rielly play on the right side? Can he be as effective on the right side?
Right.
Can Jake Muzzin? I mean, I think the veteran prerogative is almost that Muzzin gets the left side and Rielly will have to move to the right side. It'll be interesting to watch.
Well, it looks like Muzzin's going to play on the right side.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how successful they are with that combination so far, or when they finally take action. I think Friday the Leafs are next in action. And you know, for everybody you know who's planning the parade in Toronto, a friendly reminder that your second pairing defense is still Jake Gardner and Nikita Zaitsev, which has been struggling galore all season long.
Well, I don't think the Leafs are done either.
I don't think they're done either. I think they upgrade that second. Yeah. I think they upgrade that second pair.
We'll see.
I mean, it'll be interesting. I think they can. They still have prospects that they can deal from to strengthen the current team. Like you said, it's an arms race. The eight teams that have Stanley Cup aspirations, who have legitimate Stanley Cup aspirations, are going to fight tooth and nail to improve their teams from now until the 25th of February in the NHL trade deadline. When we return, the Carolina Hurricanes are one of those very interesting teams to watch ahead of the deadline. Corey Lavalette covers the Hurricanes for the North State Journal. He joins us next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We are live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast,
on TSN1290.ca.
Hour number two of NHL This Week starts now on TSN 1290. Drew Mandel, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. This segment is brought to you by Frank and Mauro Zappia of Zappia Group Realty, official realtors of Illegal Curve Hockey. When 95% of your clients come via referral, it shows your commitment to honesty, integrity, and a total dedication to client satisfaction. For all your real estate needs, come shake hands with Frank and Mauro Zappia online at zappiagroup.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome back to the program Corey Lavalette. Corey covers the Carolina Hurricanes for the North State Journal. Corey, good evening. Thanks so much for joining us.
I appreciate it.
Corey, obviously, we brought you on to talk about the Hurricanes. From my perspective, sitting here in Winnipeg, a little less than a month away from the NHL trade deadline, the Hurricanes are one of the most fascinating teams to watch. You know, they're obviously want to badly make the playoffs for the first time in basically a decade. They've already made one move in acquiring Nino Niederreiter. They have some pending unrestricted free agents. They have a plethora of defensemen. You know, I guess the first question would be, how essential is it to the organization? How desperate is it to this organization that they make the playoffs this season? Can you see them doing something foolish to maybe squeak into the playoffs, even if it causes long-term detriment to the organization?
You know, I don't think so. I think they're pretty committed to trying to carry on kind of what Ron Francis had set forward and do it the right way by building and making it a sustainable thing. So I don't think there's going to be any kind of rash decisions made. One way they could do that would be say, hey, we're going to keep Michael Ferland and run it out the rest of the year, even though it looks like they're nowhere close on a deal. So I think the plan is, and everything points to them, trading him and getting assets for him, which is, you know, at the end of the day, it's a smart decision and kind of what they need to do if they can't even, you know, get to any kind of area where they can talk to each other and get a deal done. So I don't think they're going to do anything rash. I think they're going to be smart about it, and they know there's no guarantees to making it anyway, even if you do make a deal. So I think they'll be smart about it, and that doesn't preclude them from going out and adding players. I think that's something they'd still like to do, but I think they would do it with a long-term mindset, kind of like what they did with Niederreiter.
Corey, Hurricane center Jordan Staal is still out of the lineup. He's been out of the lineup since December. The last game he played was, ironically enough, against the Pittsburgh Penguins, his former team. But it's kind of been a quiet situation, at least. It feels like it's been quiet. We haven't really heard that much about Jordan Staal. Is he close at all to coming back? And how is that going to impact what the Hurricanes and Don Waddell might or might not do?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's quiet for everyone right now just because they had the All-Star break and then they had the bye week, so we won't see him back on the ice again until tomorrow. Jordan did skate a little bit a while back, and then not with the team, but away from the team, and then was not skating again. You know, these concussion things are so hard to predict, and, you know, you want to be careful, and I think players are smarter now than they used to be about being careful, realizing what the impact can be, especially, you know, a guy with a family. You know, Michael Ferlin said the same thing when he had his. He was concerned about it, that you have to be sure. So certainly getting him back would be a huge thing. The good news is Sebastian Aho obviously has become a legitimate top-line center, I think, and has proven he can handle the workload of not only scoring on the top line but also going up against other top lines. Now you get Jordan Staal back, and you certainly want him out there handling the brunt of the workload against big-time lines like you see out east with teams like Tampa and Boston. But Aho has at least shown that he can handle some of that workload. So maybe if Jordan comes back, the biggest thing they need from him is just, you know, helping out in the penalty kill. Certainly face-offs have been a big problem since he's gone out. So they miss him, but they found ways to win without him also. So, you know, hopefully we get a little more clarification tomorrow when they get back on the ice at 2 o'clock here.
Corey, we mentioned Nino Niederreiter right off the top. I got to ask you, we've seen a lot of him here in Winnipeg, being a former Central Division dweller with the Wild. How has he looked fitting into the Hurricanes?
Yeah, I mean, I think the numbers show how he's looked. He's been great, and he's had even more chances to score than he already has. So he's been a great fit already. You don't want to jump in and say, oh, they found a replacement for Michael Ferlin by getting Nino, because while they're both those big guys who can win battles in the corners and whatnot, there's a different element to what Michael Ferlin brings. I think Nino's probably a better finisher, and Michael's more of a banger and a intimidating factor and a guy that can create space, but certainly something they've been looking for, and it's to get rid of the remaining years on Victor Rask's deal. It just wasn't working out. It's really a total win-win for them at this point.
Corey Lavalette is our guest on NHL This Week. Corey covers the Carolina Hurricanes for the North State Journal. Corey, big contract extension that the Hurricanes agreed to earlier, I guess last week or 2 weeks ago now. Tuvo Teravainen signs a 5-year extension with the Hurricanes. He gets a healthy raise from $2.86 million to $5.4 million. He's clearly established himself as a 60 or maybe even a 70-point guy in the NHL. That would be a bit of a reach there to get there this year. But, you know, the Hurricanes, since acquiring him from the Chicago Blackhawks, he's fit in pretty seamlessly as a guy that the Hurricanes can count on for significant offensive contributions.
Yeah, and he has great chemistry with Aho, which is a big part of it. They're countrymen. They just play off each other really well. The one complaint with Teuvo is you wish he maybe at the times he shot a little bit more. He's more of a pass-first player. Aho can do that a little bit sometimes too, not as much as Teravainen, but you wish he'd shoot a little more because he's got a great shot, but he manages to put up points, and certainly, you know, you always want to have your best players playing with very good players, and you know, Aho and Teravainen are a great combination. Ferland has fit well there. I think we'll certainly see more of Nito Niederreiter playing alongside them and see how that works, and then there's other options down the road too as Andrei Svechnikov matures and they give him more of a workload too.
Corey, we have to ask you more about the trade deadline because it's only a month away, and basically, that's all anybody wants to talk about here around Winnipeg and across the hockey world. But, you know, back to the Carolina group of defensemen, you know, when you hear about some of the Hurricanes that are potentially on the trade block, we already talked about Michael Ferlin. Dougie Hamilton is another one of those guys that you hear might be on the trade block, and it's pretty amazing to think that he's on the trade block because he's already been on three NHL teams, and he was just acquired by the Hurricanes less than a year ago, right? But it seems like the only Hurricanes defenseman who isn't on the trade block is Jacob Slavin. And you hear a guy like Justin Falk, because he's a pending UFA the year after this year, or maybe a guy like Brett Pesce is a guy that the Hurricanes might trade for a top six forward. I mean, which one of these defensemen is the likeliest to be moved, in your opinion?
I think if they can get the kind of player they want back, I think Justin Falk is the guy that they would prefer to move. He's got 1 year after this year on his deal. The offense has dried up a little bit, though he has played very well defensively this year. There's been a kind of a regression defensively the last couple years with Falk, really ever since Andre Sequeira was traded out to L.A. a couple years ago and then ended up in Edmonton afterward. But he's played better now that they have Calvin DeHaan. DeHaan's been a great stabilizing presence for him. But I think if there's one guy that they would probably prefer to move, it's probably Justin Falk. He's still playing on the top power play unit right now, but I've been wondering all year why Dougie Hamilton isn't in that slot. If Falk were to go, I think it's not like you're all of a sudden have a huge hole on that top power play unit with the one defenseman they play there. You just slide Hamilton right into it, and that works out. All that being said, a guy like Pesce may have more value simply because of his great contract and that there's a lot of years left on it. So they could move Hamilton, I guess. The thing about Dougie that I kind of went into this last week with something I wrote online was that he's really a second half of the year player. He's always been. Once the calendar flips for him, it seems like his offense picks up, his assists, you know, his goals, his assists pick up, and that's exactly what's happened this year. So I think we're going to see more of what the kind of player Dougie Hamilton is. He's a little bit of a slow starter, so I think the rest of the way we'll see that, and that'll, you know, I think that'll probably calm the nerves of people who wonder if they made a mistake with that.
Corey, I want to ask you about Justin Williams. I mean, this guy's playing on the first line. He's got time on the top power plays, third in the team in points, if I'm correct. And, oh, yeah, he's 37 years old. How important has his impact on the Hurricanes been this year?
Yeah, he's bounced around in the lineup a little bit. He's not playing right now with Aho, which I think would be the top line. They've kind of used him as a stabilizing force with a lot of different guys. He had a little bit of a goal drought there, and then he went and had five games in a row where he scored. And there's definitely a veteran calm to what Justin brings on the ice and in the locker room. He's got a knack for scoring goals. I think everybody knows that with his history, and he's done that even this year. He's been disappointed about how it's gone in his year and a half with the Hurricanes. I think he really thought even last year that the team was ready to be a playoff team, and obviously that didn't happen. But I think I wouldn't be surprised to see Justin come back after this year, even though he's going to be an unrestricted free agent. Obviously, he and Rod Brind'Amour were line mates together back in the day when the Hurricanes won the Stanley Cup. They're really close. He's the captain. He's been a great influence on the team. And then, you know, other additions that they've made in the last couple of years, Jordan Martinuk's been a great influence. You know, has really changed the way the locker room is and the way, really the way the team works and operates.
Corey Lavallette is our guest on NHL This Week. Corey covers the Carolina Hurricanes for the North State Journal. Corey, final question for you. We've talked most of this interview about the Hurricanes being a seller at trade deadline or in and around the trade deadline. Could you see a scenario where the Hurricanes, currently 4 points out of the final wild card spot in the Eastern Conference, could also be a buyer, maybe specifically in goal to shore up that position, which has been a rotating cast of characters for really the last 4 or 5 years?
I don't see anything happening with goaltending the rest of the way this year, unless this little knee flare up with Curtis McElhinney is a bigger deal than they thought it was. They gave him a good rest leading up to the All-Star break, and now he's had this long kind of 8-day stretch to rest on top of that. McElhinney's been great. Mrazek's numbers aren't great, but he's actually played pretty well in most situations. I think they're satisfied with how those guys are. They don't see that as the problem right now. The way they would buy is what we talked about earlier, which is they've got a surplus of defensemen. They feel like Caden Fleury's an NHL defenseman who's just doesn't have a spot right now to play, really. So if they can use one of those right-handed defensemen to get another top six forward, or if they, you know, use Ferland and try to get a guy back that that can play now, potentially, you know, certainly they would welcome that, I think, to add a little more firepower to the front. Like you said, they get Jordan Staal back, so that's like adding a player at the trade deadline when that happens. And you know, I haven't heard anything about him missing the rest of the year or anything crazy like that. So you know, I think they could add players, but I think it would be more of a hockey trade than a rental situation.
Corey Lavallette covers the Carolina Hurricanes for the North State Journal. Corey, appreciate your time and insight. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you, guys. I appreciate it.
Take care, Corey. Before we head to break, I want to make note of a passing of a Winnipeg sports legend earlier this evening. Bob Pickin has been a fixture in the Winnipeg sporting community for much of the last 50 years. He passed away earlier today at the age of 86 years old. We know him as sort of the voice of curling in Manitoba. He was a wonderful gentleman. He embraced Illegal Curve when we sort of made our approach here on the sports scene in Winnipeg, immediately welcomed us in as members of the Manitoba Sports Writers and Sportscasters Association. Bob Pickin was a tremendous gentleman. He was a tremendous sports fixture in the city of Winnipeg, and the sporting community in Manitoba is lesser today, having lost him at the age of 86. All the best to him and his family on his passing. When we return, we're going to talk about 3-on-3 overtime. Is it time to extend it beyond 5 minutes? You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast,
on TSN1290.ca.
Drops it back for Ricard Raquel. That shot blocked by Trouba. 15 seconds, Little and Trouba. Fowler on his way back in a hurry. In for Little. Save me. Rebound. They bang. Score!
Brian Little scoring in overtime for the Winnipeg Jets. That came against the Anaheim Ducks back earlier this month. The Jets have been very successful in 3-on-3 overtime so far this season. An interesting article on TSN.ca earlier this week about is it time for the NHL to extend 3-on-3 overtime beyond the 5 minutes that it currently is. Welcome back to NHL This Week. Drew Mindell, Sean Assor, Ezra Ginsberg with you in studio. This segment of the show brought to you by our friends at Keener Jerseys, located at 982 Portage Avenue. That's the corner of Portage and Sherburn. At Keener Jerseys, making a better jersey is what they do. To have your jersey customized or order new jerseys for your rec team, go to KeenerJerseys.com. Keener Jerseys, they're on your team. So Travis Yost with the interesting article on TSN.ca. And as you know, I know you're not a fan of the shootout.
No.
And, you know, 3-on-3 overtime is certainly gimmicky, but it's an entertaining gimmick.
Can you believe it's been almost 15 years since the shootout has existed?
That's crazy.
Like, there's
that
young
is crazy.
There's young hockey fans
15,
out
no
there.
No way. Has it really been 15 years?
2005.
Oh, we're so old.
Wow, when did we get that old? God, that's depressing.
Well, you've been old for a long time.
Touche.
I've still got some good years here.
I don't know.
Shawnee and I have got some good years.
Yeah.
I'm so
Shawnee's
old.
Got, Shawnee's got good years.
I'm so I don't know old. What,
you yeah. and I are fathers. No, once you become a father, it's all... You know, you have great years, but let's be honest, you're just old at that point in time.
We're really washed up.
Oh, really?
Like when
up.
When you're going to bed at 9 o'clock on a Saturday, that's when you know you're really.
Well,
washed
I'll tell you
up.
What.
That sounds lovely.
I was listening in anticipation for Saturday's 10th anniversary show. By the way, we're celebrating 10 years of Illegal Curve radio on Saturday. I was listening to some old clips, some what we used to call escapades. And looking back at when you
that's when I used to be an alcoholic.
Oh, man. When you were in your peak, like you went on like about a 3 or 4 month bender back in, I think it was 2014. That was just epic. That nowadays, man, you are washed up compared to the fun you had back then.
Well, that was before Naomi.
Yeah, there were dark days. You were in some dark days back then.
Yeah,
I mean, the times were, you know.
A lot of pizzas, a lot of...
I mean, listening to you talking about...
A lot of craft dinner.
Well, listening to you talk about frying up pierogies at 2:30 in the morning because you come home and there's no food in your house and that's the best you can do. You haven't seen 2:30 in the morning. The only time you've been up at 2:30 in the morning recently is to deal with your kid.
Yeah, it's true.
Anyways, 3-on-3 overtime.
Very
we are old. 770 games have been played so far this season. 21% of those games have gone to overtime. You know, that since then, that 74% of those games have been resolved in the 5 minutes of 3-on-3.
Right.
Is it time to extend 3-on-3 to resolve even more games in the 3-on-3 before heading to the shootout?
If you're asking me personally, I would love to see a 10-minute overtime. And I've said this before, and I don't think this is going to happen, but I would love to see the shootout disappear, really, because I don't like... Not only do I not like the shootout as a way of determining a game, I don't like the fact that you get a point for winning the shootout. Like, I think that you should be rewarded for winning a game in regulation. And Huss from the station has talked about this many times before. Well, it makes a lot of sense, Drew.
Of course
it does. If you think about it, there shouldn't be this many teams in it come March. I mean, I realize the NHL loves it. The NHL loves parity. But as far as I'm concerned, I would love to see a 10-minute overtime, no shootout. If the game's tied, each team gets a point. The team that wins in regulation gets 3 points. That's what I would like to see personally. Because when you talk about overtime, guys, 3-on-3 overtime, I think, aside from sudden death overtime in the playoffs, is the most exciting part of regular season hockey. It really is. And you watch some of the finishes that we've seen this year, right? Mark Scheifele with the 3 overtime winners. You know, Kyle Connor scored the overtime winner, Shawnee. I think the Jets have, how many wins did the Jets have in overtime this year? 5?
I was going to say 8, but that seems high. But
that many? I thought it was 5.
Yeah, between 5 and 8.
There's only three other numbers it could be at that point in time. So
let's say 6.5.
Okay, that's just split the difference. I like it. So you mentioned extending it to 10 minutes. So the data that Travis Yost crunched basically says that if you were to extend 3-on-3 overtime by 4 more minutes, so let's say you were going to make it a 9-minute overtime.
You would never do that.
Of course, it's a random number.
You would do a multiple of 5.
You would do a multiple of 5. You wouldn't do 9 minutes. It doesn't make any sense. But if you were to go up to all the way up to 9 minutes, let's say, you would resolve close to 90% of your games without having it to go to a shootout.
And don't you want that as a fan? Mm-hmm.
As a fan, you would. I mean, I think...
I mean, how exciting was the shootout yesterday? I mean, that was a perfect example of a shootout where one goal was scored... And the finish of the game was kind of like, wah, wah, wah.
I mean, it's certainly more dull than 3-on-3 overtime, but I thought the 3-on-3 overtime yesterday was also a little bit more dull than some of the other ones we've seen.
It just feels kind of anticlimactic to end the game in a shootout. And I like you, Ezzy, I can't stand when games are decided in it. I really can't stand when a playoff spot is decided upon it. Like, if a season comes down to a shootout, that to me is, it's almost criminal. And... In an era where speed and skill are at the forefront, the game has never been more enjoyable to watch from a speed and skill perspective. I mean, why not add 5 more minutes of 3-on-3 overtime? It makes for an enjoyable viewing experience. Live, it's exciting.
Do you think the players would ever go for it? I mean, I'm sure
I think we would see a different deployment of players in that case. I don't think you would see the same 6 players being ridden throughout a 5-minute period. You know, I think you would go deeper into the bench.
Well, because I'm sure what the NHLPA would say is, well, it's too taxing on players to play an extra, you know, 4 or 5 minutes of 3-on-3
Asking them to
overtime.
Play 3 games in 5 days is also taxing, but the schedule maker puts that out anyway, so.
I would also think that the players would be more in favor of that than the owners.
Because of the risk that the why wouldn't the owners be in favor of it?
Well, I think that the NHL owners care about one thing. They care about money.
Sure.
So how does this benefit them? How does this make them more money? It doesn't.
It doesn't. I mean, you can argue that their fans are more engaged because it's a more entertaining form of deciding a game.
I think TV networks would like it.
I mean, I don't know anybody that prefers the shootout to 3-on-3 overtime. Now, 4-on-4 overtime, which is what they had, you know, most recently until 3-on-3 was instituted, was getting to the point where it was a little bit dull also. It wasn't as... I mean, the 3-on-3 is freewheeling. It's exciting. Yep. There's usually chances at both ends. Last night's game was a bit of an anomaly in that it wasn't... it was sort of a duller 3-on-3 overtime, I thought. I agree. I mean, I don't see a downside to it, so I'm not sure who's against it, but it's one of those things, the NHL being the NHL and the Players Association not wanting to give an inch and the ownership not wanting to give an inch means it's never going to happen.
Well, sure, I agree with that, but when you're talking about the shootout, if you go back to the early 90s or even the mid-90s, how many people actually thought that there would be a shootout one day? I mean, you forget that it wasn't that long ago that there were tie games.
And hook and hooking.
Right? And there was and hooking and all and that. Grabbing. And even as recent as 5 or 6 years ago, people would say, you know, it's ridiculous that Vegas is going to get a hockey team. Those people aren't saying that now.
So you're saying just wait, times will change?
And again, I'm not, maybe, but I mean, expect the unexpected, right? I mean, we just didn't, I mean, growing up as a kid, watching the Jets in the early 90s, I mean, the shootout was just not something that you thought about, right? You just didn't think games would be determined with the shootout. And
games you'd play 5 minutes of 5-on-5 overtime, and then it would resolve nothing. I mean, I remember there's the seminal one, of course, is when the Jets won by throwing the puck into the net against the Blackhawks. Who was that? Was it Nelson Emerson?
Yep.
Nelson Emerson, and somehow they allowed that goal, even with video review. One of the actually that was
was it, that against Chicago? It was against Eddie Chicago. Belfour.
Eddie Belfour. Yeah.
Yeah.
Until the Saints and Rams playoff game, that was the worst use of video review ever, or the lack of use of video review. I also remember, and I think it must have been the Jets last season, Dallas Drake scored in overtime, also against the Blackhawks. The Jets won 1-0 on an overtime goal. That was also, you know, over 20 years ago at this point in time. But you're right. I mean,
probably assisted by Craig Janney.
I don't remember who assisted. I don't know if Janney had been on, was acquired by the team yet. That was a trade deadline acquisition back in 95, if you remember correctly. But, you know, you're right. Maybe it'll change. I don't see any sort of groundswell of support for this idea. I don't hear it being talked about, but it'd be something I would be in favor of. I think most people would be as well. I think the players would say, no, five is enough. It's too exhausting.
There has to be a reason to do it, right? There has to be the impetus.
Yeah, I don't see the impetus there yet. I think the NHL and the NHLPA are fine with deciding games in a shootout when it gets to that point.
They get decided regardless. It's whether or not you want to give the fans a little bit more excitement.
Fair enough. When we return, as we've mentioned throughout the program, it is Bell Let's Talk Day. Our good friend Scott Billick, you know him from NHL.com, you know him from Winnipeg Sun. He had a really profound Twitter thread earlier today about his struggles with mental health. We're going to talk to Scott about his struggles and, you know, all wrapping it up as part of Bell Let's Talk Day here on the station. That's coming up next. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN 1290.ca.
Bottom of the hour, Wednesday evening. More so than it being Wednesday evening, it's Bell Let's Talk Day here, as you are certainly well aware. I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Welcome back to NHL This Week. I'm joined in studio by Sean Assor and Ezra Ginsberg. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve, and our website with latest Winnipeg Jets and Manitoba Moose news and audio is IllegalCurve.com.
Now, let's go live on the Illegal Curve Hockey Show Hotline.
We're pleased to welcome back to the program a good friend of ours, Scott Billick. Scott, of course, covers the Winnipeg Jets for NHL.com. You know him from his work with the Winnipeg Sun as well as NBC's NHL Pro Hockey Talk. Easy for me to say. Scotty, good evening. Thanks very much for joining us.
Hey, how's it going? It's my debut on the midweek show. So
it is your debut on the midweek. Yes, I hope it's a milestone for you, as it is for us. You know, obviously, we have you on Saturdays, and we talk about the Jets, and we, you know, talk about what's happening, and, you know, we always, have a tendency, especially in sports, to make things out to be more than they are, more than just a game. You had a great Twitter thread earlier today talking about your struggles with mental health, your struggles with depression, your struggles with anxiety. And, you know, I'm fortunate in that I don't suffer from those things. And I can you maybe explain to our audience the strength that it takes to really put yourself out there and be open and honest about the struggles that you have gone through and that you currently do go through on occasion?
Yeah, I mean, no, it's hard, you know, you kind of trying to, you know, toot my own horn here. But, you know, there is a certain strength to it, I suppose. I mean, it's tough, right? And I think largely, for the most part, you know, you can begin to talk about it once you kind of have an understanding of it. And once you kind of have a little bit of it under control, you know, I'd say at the end of the day, you know, for the most part, I live happy on most days, right? So, but there's some that I don't do. Sometimes, you know, either the meds don't do what they need to do, or I'm mistaking them, or whatever it is, and then you kind of back into it, and that's when, you know, years of trying to work through it and learning different ways to cope and that sort of thing come in handy. You know, I guess the strength of it, and just wanting to share. I mean, that just comes from, you know, the support that I've gotten over the years, right? I mean, I just feel a need to give back and not let this be something that just kind of hides. And it's easier now to do that than it was, say, you know, 7 or 8 years ago when I first kind of got diagnosed. And even earlier than that, when I realized I actually was dealing with this, you know, back in the, you know, the early 2000s, where you would never talk about this kind of stuff. And you didn't even know kind of what you were feeling was at the point. So, you know, it's taken a long time to be able to get to where I am. So, yeah, I would assume that, you know, for me, that the strength just comes from dealing with it for a long time and kind of, I guess, having as much of a handle on it as I can have.
You know, Scott, you first came out with your story. You wrote the story on your personal website 6 years ago, and you know, it was obviously that's not easy to do. And I've talked to you about this before because you know we both struggle with depression and anxiety, and the hardest part is to kind of explain to people, you know, how bad it can really get. But the question I was going to ask you is, why is it so important for you to each year on Bell Let's Talk Day to update your story and keep that dialogue going? Is it so that you can help someone who might be going through the same things as you? Because obviously it's not just about one day. You should be sharing these types of stories and feelings all year long.
Yeah, I mean, I guess suppose today is the best platform to do so. You know, when I first shared this 6 years ago, I didn't have, you know, close to 4,000 followers on Twitter, right? So I didn't have that platform. And, you know, a large part of writing it at the time was kind of therapeutic and you know, just to, you know, the little platform that I had then, even the one that I have now, just able to maybe talk to some people. And like you said, I mean, you've talked about it. I've talked to, you know, several people in the press box and then just other people on Twitter who send me direct messages and that sort of thing. So, you know, I guess that's why, you know, to me, it's important that, you know, there were people there for me when, you know, my wife is the biggest one, but, you know, there was others there, friends and that sort of thing. And as much as you kind of, during going through a tough time where you kind of shun a lot of people out of your life because you just don't know or don't have the motivation to get up and do anything or whatever. I mean, you know, I lost two jobs because of it. I mean, there's a lot of things that happened while I was, you know, when it really kind of came to a head at one point. And, you know, so for me, just to share the message, to kind of, you know, I guess update how I'm doing with it. I mean, it's not like, you know, you write a story 6 years ago and then everything's fine, right? I mean, it, you know, for the last however many days it's been, right? Every day of the year, it's something that you, you know, you deal with and you work through and you medicate yourself for and you use the skills that you've picked up. So I mean, I guess for me, it's just, you know, if I can talk to one person about it today and today I was able to talk to a few people, you know, and that to me is, you know, what it's about. It's hoping that people can kind of, I guess, take whatever they can from my story, whatever it is, and just trying to make it, I guess, as human as possible. I mean, it's tough to explain, right? I mean, I'm a better writer than I am a talker, but to be able to just, you know, to put a face to it that some people might know, and not, you know, I'm not some, you know, NHL star or some, you know, high-paid actor or anything like that. I'm just a, you know, a guy in the city that writes about hockey. Right? The thing is, you know, it can happen to anybody. And I think, you know, I just, yeah, again, it's hard to explain, but I just want people to be able to kind of, you know, share their own story, or at least to be able to kind of talk about, you know, whatever they're dealing with. And if I can help that in any way, I mean, that's kind of what it's about for me.
Scotty, I wanted to ask you about Project 11 and other mental health, you know, initiatives and programs designed to help people. And something that's really important, in my opinion, is the age group at which some of these organizations, I don't want to use the word target, but, you know, kind of advertise, but let's go with target. They target kids, you know, between kindergarten and then grade 4 and then grades 5 to 8. So, you know, children and young kids that are really into those developmental years. And I just want to, from your perspective, how important is it to kind of kick the stigma early, you know, that you're not weak and you can get help and you can ask for help, especially with such like young kids in these developmental years, so they can shake the stigma later on in life and it doesn't, you know, they're essentially not being weighed down through their maturation process.
Yeah, I mean, I'm no expert when it comes to the medical side of it or even the psychological side. I mean, I know what I know, and what I know is that, you know, if I could have talked about this stuff when I was 13, when I the earliest that I kind of remember this being a thing, I mean, at that point, I think that the year was when I was 13, it must have been 1999 or 2000, And you know, nobody's talking about this stuff then. And I would imagine if you kind of talk about this stuff while you're a, you know, a grade six or seven student, you know, going through middle school or whatever, the reaction isn't going to be, you know, one of compassion. It's going to be probably some bullying and that sort of thing, right? So you kind of hide it. And you know, for a while, you know, I did. I mean, I didn't even know I was hiding it for a while. So, you know, to answer your question, I mean, I think that the earlier the better, right? Because it can obviously stop or hopefully prevent some of the bullying that comes with it, to normalize it a little more among kids, and just to get to kids when, you know, if it is happening early, they're allowed, they're able to access whatever resources. I mean, it took me until I was, honestly, I was like 23 or 24 before I actually got diagnosed. So, I mean, that's a long time to kind of deal with something you don't even really know what it is, right? So the earlier that the kids can kind of work on and develop the skills and that sort of thing, I think that's it's a huge thing to target, you know, kids as young as you can, who are, you know, willing and can kind of, I guess, identify kind of what they're feeling.
Scott Billick is our guest on NHL This Week. He joins us as part of Bell Let's Talk to talk about mental health awareness and his struggle with depression and anxiety. Scott, in your Twitter thread that I mentioned earlier off the start of the interview, you had a great line in there, I thought, that really resonated with me. One thing about meds, this is what you write, they aren't a cop-out. And of course they're not, because, you know, if I have a cut, I put a Band-Aid on it. If I have a headache, I take a Tylenol to relieve the headache. Do you think that stigma of needing medicine, of needing drugs, of needing pills, you know, to help with your mental health awareness is beginning to lift, that nobody sort of judges you anymore for requiring medicine to get through your day?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, at least for me it has. I mean, I guess for me it's just, you know, I could care less what anybody thinks about me taking meds. I could care less about a lot of those things, right? Because I know that it does help me, and I know that it can help others, right? I mean, the one line that I used today too, and the one that I heard long ago when I was in university, was pills with skills. And before I knew any of this stuff, I had a psychology professor, you know, you share that, right? It was pills with skills. So you take the meds, and then you develop, you know, alongside that coping mechanism, so you don't have to, you know, maybe rely on the pills all that often. Or if you do have to rely on the pills, you can still get by, you know, if a panic attack is coming or whatever it might be, right? You don't have to just, you know, pop a clonazepam or lorazepam or whatever, you know, you might take to do that. You can kind of, you know, work on breathing techniques or whatever it is, right? So, but yeah, like, I don't think, you know, part of the process, and I think it is for a lot of people, is to kind of get a handle on it. The medication helps. It's just like you're trying to get a handle on a headache that's not going away, you take an Advil. You know, why should it be any different? Like, obviously, some of these drugs are prescription drugs. The ones that I take, of course, are. But you know, you're not getting them at the grocery store. But at the same time, I mean, they're just another tool that helps you. And I think there's also not a stigma, but just I don't know what the word is, an apprehension for people to take drugs, and you don't know what the long-term side effects are and that sort of thing. But, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, as long as I'm living, I want to live as well as I can, and the medication helps me do that. And that's really what it is for me. That's what it's about. It's just, you know, I take them because I need them, and they help, and they help me, you know, kind of make it through the day to day and live happy, and have a happy life.
You know, Scotty, we brought you on to talk about Bell Let's Talk, but you, of course, cover the Winnipeg Jets for NHL.com and yep, NBC Pro Hockey Talk, so we have to ask you one last question, and it has to be about the Jets. Obviously, the Jets got the big shootout win over the Bruins last night, and they've got Columbus coming up tomorrow night, and, you know, with the three-game homestand coming up here, what are some of the storylines that you're looking for here with, you know, some desperate teams coming into Winnipeg?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I was on Kevin O's show this morning, the Roundtable, and
Scott, we actually don't talk about that show on our
show. Yeah. All right, I want to.
Kevin who?
Kevin, yeah. Kevin
Voldemort.
Same,
so. He who shall not be named.
That's right. Fair enough. He doesn't like the illegal curve sandwich. I take it. So I got it.
He sent it back.
Yeah. No, the storylines for me, obviously, I think for me, some consistency in the Jets game, you know, having a first period like they did, you know, that would cripple a lot of teams. And, you know, the Jets with Connor Hellebuck were able to work through that. But, you know, heading towards the playoffs, I think you need to find some consistency in your game where, you know, because in the playoffs, if you spot a team a two-goal lead or whatever it is in the playoffs, or you don't get as lucky and you don't get as great a goaltending as they got last night, I mean, that's just, you know, you're down a game in the series or whatever the scenario might be. So I think, you know, for me, to see this team find some consistency is what they're looking for. And then obviously there's Patrick Laine. I, you know, you look at the roster and it's kind of weird because you don't really know what you can do with him. Again, and a lot of people say, okay, sure, you know, you can shuffle the lines or whatever. But, you know, again, from what Paul Maurice has said, he likes the top line. He likes the quote unquote third line, Adam Lowry's line. And he likes the fourth line their ability to kind of drive, not necessarily offense, but just do what a fourth line kind of does. Just that gritty, quote unquote. I know people don't like that word, but I mean, that's kind of what that line does, and Paul Maurice likes it. So then you have, you know, this whole thing with Line A playing with Little, and people aren't sure that. So I think that's the storyline too. I mean, I think at some point you got to throw Line A a lifeline, whether that lifeline's Maxi Perreault, whether it's a combination of Mark Scheifele or Blake Wheeler or both. I mean, at some point you want to get him going again because you don't want him to get down, and you don't want them to kind of let him kind of waste away, and you know, you're not going to sit a 25 goal score, so that's out of the question. So at some point you got to throw him a bone and hope he bites it. And you know, I think, you know, we've seen Patrick Laine do it, and I'd like to see him in my mind play a little more with Matthew Perreault, see if that could flourish a little bit. And then who knows when Nikolaj Ehlers comes back, if those guys can kind of rekindle anything, if there was anything there before really. But you know, those are the two. It's consistency and Laine's game over the next three games that I think are going to be two of the things that are going to get talked about probably the most around here.
Scott Billick covers the Winnipeg Jets for NHL.com. You also know his work from NBC's Pro Hockey Talk and the Winnipeg Sun. Scott, thanks so much for joining us, telling your story about your battle with mental health and mental health awareness. We always appreciate you being so honest and forthcoming when you join us.
Yeah, I appreciate it, guys. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
Take care, Scotty.
Thanks a lot, Scotty.
When we come back, one final segment. We'll look at the out-of-town scoreboard. I'll be okay. And we'll talk about the puck and player tracking that was introduced at the All-Star Game. You're listening to NHL This Week. We're live on TSN Radio 1290.
This is NHL Midweek,
the podcast
on TSN1290.ca.
We intend to deploy this technology in all 31 arenas next season, with the specific goal of bringing our fans a closer view inside the game. We are committed to ensuring that the NHL is at the forefront of all new technology. With the speed and complexity of hockey, it makes for an unparalleled on-ice product. The applications are endless.
That's NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman talking.
What happened to your voice, man?
I've lost my voice over the course of the last couple hours. I felt a tickle, and I've had a tickle for the last couple days, and clearly I've spoken too much over the last 2 hours, and this is what you get instead. Gravelly voice Drew Mandel instead of normal, chipper, high-pitched voice Drew Mandel. Is it a little sexier?
It's very Phoebe Buffay. When she gets the cold, remember? And then she sings all sexy and everything? Yeah.
Should I sing Smelly Cat?
Yeah.
Smelly Cat, okay, no. Smelly Cat, what are they feeding you? As he's looking at me like, what am I doing?
Please never do that again. What is Smelly Cat?
You know the song she sings on
it's
Friends?
Phoebe Buffay's hit single from Friends.
Like, don't pretend you don't know that.
I never watched Friends.
Oh, sorry.
I'm a Seinfeld
guy. Too busy watching
guy.
The Bachelor.
Yeah, you're now on your high horse because you watch The Bachelor and Bachelor in Paradise.
I like Joey
instead.
And Chandler. Aside from Joey and Chandler, the rest of the characters.
I didn't say they were great characters. I just said I know the song. You know, that's acceptable.
Phoebe was kind of funny.
Yeah, Smelly Cat. Who writes a song about a smelly
She's
cat?
She's no Elaine Bennis.
Well, look, I mean, if you're asking me which one's better, Friends or Seinfeld, there's no competition. It's Seinfeld.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus never ages. Like, she looks exactly the same as she did 20 years ago.
It's true. I don't know if you guys watch Veep.
Great.
But Veep is so inappropriate.
Isn't it VIP?
No, that's keys to the VIP.
I've never watched Veep either.
Veep.
How much TV do you watch?
I don't watch that much.
Do you watch like Chicago Fire and, no, and those type of shows?
No, I don't watch those shows. Veep is about the she's the vice president. Okay. Hence Veep, not VIP. But you know what, idiot. But anyways, that show is so inappropriate. It makes me absolutely burst out laughing almost multiple times per episode. Anyways, let's go to the out-of-town scoreboard. A couple games in the NHL tonight. Bit of an upset, certainly brewing, more than brewing in Pittsburgh. The Penguins taking the Lightning to the woodshed 4-0 after 40 minutes in Pittsburgh. Goals by Riley Shan, Phil Kessel, Sidney Crosby, and Chris Letang. A very impressive outing by the Penguins so far against the Lightning. And then in Dallas, with about 6 minutes to go in the second period, Jamie Benn has the only goal. They lead the Buffalo Sabres 1-0. The Stars looking to maintain their standing in the NHL's playoff race in the Western Conference. That's the extent of the out-of-town scoreboard. A quiet Wednesday night in the NHL.
Yeah, thank God for Friday and Saturday, because there were only two games yesterday,
yeah,
two games tonight, and three tomorrow, right?
Yeah. Well, it's everybody's coming back from the break. Some right. teams are on their bye week. It's just a very odd schedule for the past couple weeks, but it'll get busy this weekend, of course. The Jets, tomorrow night against the Columbus Blue Jackets, Saturday night against the Anaheim Ducks, Tuesday night against the San Jose Sharks for a three-game homestand before they head back out on the road to Eastern Canada.
Yeah, I don't know if we're talking about player and puck.
You can talk about player trade. Do you have any interest in this?
Well, yeah, let's get into it for a little bit here. We have a couple minutes. I think James is going to give us the signal. But
2 minutes, James says.
When you're talking about the All-Star game here, I think everybody agrees. Some of the graphics that they were showing, when they showed the face-off and all the different names, first of all, you didn't even see all the names because they were hidden behind other names. And that's pretty ridiculous in and of itself that they thought that some fans would want to see that, but I think when you're
it's
talking
like tagging
about
somebody on Instagram, but putting one person's tag over top of somebody else's tag,
right? And I know you read the article, Greg Wyshynski, who you know we've had on the show many times before. Uh-huh. I thought he had a really good article at ESPN.com because he talked about who is player and puck tracking technology really for. Is it for the fans? Is it for you know pro scouts? Is it for GMs, players? Is it for you know the television stations? I mean, who is it really going to benefit? And I really think it's broadcasters. I mean, we would be included, right? So when you're talking about you know this player and puck tracking technology, and you know being able to tell you know how fast a player is going or how fast their shot is, and ice time and all that type of stuff, I don't necessarily know that your average fan is going to want that much of this technology. Like, I think you can already get a lot of the advanced stats online, either on NHL.com or sites like, you know, Natural Stat Trick, stuff like that, right? So I think, you know,
does it change your perception of Blake Wheeler to find out he's skating 24 miles an hour this game as opposed to 22 miles an hour game the previous?
Well, and that's why I think that as this technology, you know, advances, you're going to start to see things like fans tracking this type of stuff on an app. Like, I don't necessarily know that you want to see all of this stuff. Like, do you want to watch hockey pop-up video? You know what I mean? Like, do you want to see all of this stuff while you're watching hockey and you're being inundated with all these different stats, right? I think at the end of the day, you want to watch the game, but you know, we're just seeing it right now in its infancy, so you know we have to
time
wait and see
tell
where it's going.
That's it for the Wednesday edition of NHL This Week. A big thank you to our sponsors, Rumors Restaurant and Comedy Club, Linden Market Dental Center, Bernstein's Deli, Zappia Group Realty, and Keener Jerseys. Support these fine local businesses because they support Illegal Curve Hockey. Big thank you to our guest, Scott Billick, joined us as part of Bell Let's Talk. We were joined by Corey Lavallette of the North State Journal to talk about the Carolina Hurricanes, and Aaron Portsline to join us about the Columbus Blue Jackets. In case you missed any of the show, it's available for download on tsn1290.ca, on our website, illegalcurve.com. Get it wherever you get your podcasts. Big thanks to producer James DeRoschuk on the board, for Sean Asor, for Ezra Ginsberg. I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Until Saturday morning at 9 a.m. when we celebrate 10 years of Illegal Curve Hockey, we wish you good night and good luck.